Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Welcome back to Let's Talk ETFs. I trust that everyone's Thanksgiving was enjoyable. You managed to stay safe while seeing some friends or loved ones. This episode is with Paul Baiocchi of Alps. He was last on the show along with Stacey Morris of Valerian on Thursday, October 22nd, in an episode titled The ETF Investor's Guide to MLPs with Valerian and Alps. If you haven't already heard that episode, you may want to go back and check it out before diving into this one. Anyway, I hope you enjoy. For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the morning of Wednesday, September 30th, 2020. Today, my guest is Paul Baiocchi. Paul is a senior investment strategy advisor at SS&C Alps, spearheading the firm's distribution strategy and execution for the Valerian MLP and Energy Infrastructure ETF suite, working closely with the distribution teams to tailor the firm's messaging around AMLP and ENFR to meet the needs of varied institutional clients. Previously, Paul was Vice President of ETF Business Development at Fidelity Institutional Asset Management, where he helped build and grow the firm's ETF lineup. Before that, he worked at ETF.com, building an ETF analytics platform, writing about the ETF industry, and moderating panels at Inside ETFs conferences. He holds a bachelor's degree in business administration from California State University at Chico, an MBA from the University of British Columbia's Sauder School of Business, and is also a CFA charter holder. Anyway, welcome back to the show, Paul. Great to have you back so soon.
Great to be back. Thanks, Jonathan.
Sure. And for those listening at home, this has been about a 10-minute break here. We're recording these back to back, but you'll be listening to these maybe 3 or 4 weeks apart. So, Paul, you've been in the ETF space for quite a while at this point. I remember reading your stuff on ETF.com probably like 15 years ago at this point. And I guess before we get into what you're up to right now and your views on how far the ETF space has come over the last 15 years or so, what was it that drew you to exchange-traded funds specifically way back when?
So in some ways, I think it's similar to how a lot of people got into the ETF world. And you know, that's not to sort of denigrate the a lot of leadership in the ETF space. But I think in many ways, people sort of backed into ETFs in the sense that they worked at an asset manager who was starting to dabble in the ETF space. They were sort of put on assignment there and then realized or appreciated the opportunity set and then forged a career in the category as it grew or sort of rode the wave. And in some ways, that's similar to where I was. I was working, I was actually going to school. I was going to grad school and I had a former colleague that had a small RIA down in Southern California who was doing some sub-advisory work for Claymore at the time, which has since been absorbed into the Guggenheim brand, which is now, I believe, part of the Invesco empire. And they were
definitely
building,
changed hands a bunch of times.
Yeah. So they were building unit investment trusts, and we were sort of creating indexes for thematic unit investment trusts, including Canadian Royal Royalty Trust, which sort of ties into my MLP focus now, although Canadian Royalty Trusts have since gone away as a result of some changes in the regulatory landscape up in Canada. But then, you know, we were being asked to do global infrastructure unit investment trusts and the like. And Claymore came to us and said, will you build an index for a global shipping ETF? Which, you know, in retrospect, the timing wasn't great. This was 2007, 2008, when the global economy was about to sort of fall off a cliff. But it did get me introduced to the ETF wrapper in a meaningful way. And we actually did launch the first global shipping ETF based on our index. And I was part of that process of building and weighting and creating a methodology. And so I started getting deeper and deeper into the ETF wrapper and the mechanics of it, creation, redemption process, all of the sort of structural nuances of ETFs. And I came to realize just how significant an opportunity it represented and how much it was going to disrupt. And obviously the stage at which I joined ETF.com, which was 2010, was almost perfect timing, because if you look from the financial crisis on is when ETFs really started to see a massive acceleration in their growth. I mean, the first ETFs had been launched well before then in the late 90s, but it wasn't until after the financial crisis or coming out of the financial crisis that you started to see widespread adoption of ETFs. And so I took a job at ETF.com as part of an analyst team to help build what we thought at the time would be a competitor to Morningstar from a research and classification perspective. And it just got me immersed in not just the ETF wrapper and the competitive landscape, but also allowed me to network within the industry in a way that was really unique. We had executives from all these issuers coming in and making a case for their lineup and for their strategies. And over time, over the course of the 4 years or so that I was there, I learned so much about ETF users, ETF creators, index providers on down. And it's just something that I feel is very democratic in the sense that it benefits investors in a way that is unique. And it aligns really well with this idea that active managers have a very difficult time outperforming their benchmarks, and passive investments are in many categories very appropriate for investors. And perhaps more to the point, that the more of your money that you invest that you can keep, the better off you are long term. And that's, I think, one of the key tenets of the ETF wrapper. You don't have TA fees. You don't have a lot of these embedded overhead costs that you have in the legacy mutual fund wrapper. And as such, you have a clear line of sight between your investment dollars and returns on those investment dollars and what actually translates to your account. And then, of course, the tax efficiency is part and parcel to all of that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's rare that you, I think, find new developments in any space, really, that are basically an unmitigated good. But I think, by and large, exchange-traded funds, at least kind of the simple non, you know, triple leverage types or whatever, really do fall into that category. So they really just have made investing more transparent, more affordable, given access to tons of different types of strategies and asset classes that really were the kinds of things that only Wall Street could access until exchange traded funds were available. And as you've said, it really democratized things very much as a result of that. So you mentioned the legacy mutual fund business, and I'm not sure about yourself. I still own some mutual funds from back in the day from a 401k that I simply never rolled over to anything else. There are some American funds, things like Growth Fund of America, storied funds. Certainly the performance hasn't been bad. Definitely paying more fees than I would be if I had a similar index type ETF. Why do you think it is that mutual fund assets continue to dwarf exchange traded fund assets? Does the stickiness of mutual fund assets surprise you in any way, particularly considering the many advantages ETFs confer over mutual funds?
I mean, some of it's structural in nature. So you mentioned 401ks, and that is historically been a really large market for mutual funds. And it's not a nut that the ETF market has really been able to crack, whether it's because of the limitations of partial shares or whether it's just the sort of structural nature of 401k platforms. You know, outside of sort of brokerage links and sort of backdoor ways to get exposure to ETFs, it's not all that easy for people to get ETFs in their lineup of choice within a mutual fund or within a 401k. And so you think about someone who started a 401k 30 years ago or 25 years ago or 20 years ago, and they've just been sort of investing and getting a company match into that program. they have these sort of legacy positions in mutual funds that aren't necessarily at risk of converting to ETFs unless they roll it over to an IRA. And then in that case, maybe they reconfigure the exposure to get a portfolio of ETFs in place of that mutual fund. So I don't think it's all that surprising that there are still a tremendous amount of assets in mutual funds. And I think a lot of that is driven by 401k assets, but it's also worth mentioning that there are index mutual funds out there on offer from a number of asset managers that are just as cheap, if not cheaper, than the sort of corresponding index ETF. And so in the passive space, the trade-off for cost isn't as significant as it might be when going from, say, active to passive, or from an active mutual fund to a passive ETF. And I think adding context to all this is the idea that, you know, capital gains distributions, which are much more likely to come from a mutual fund than they are from an ETF, all else equal, are less of a consideration for a deferred account for a 401k investor. And so that tax efficiency piece of the ETF is sort of less important in the 401k wrapper as well. And so you sort of have, I think, a number of different dynamics at work that make the mutual fund have sort of a moat around some of those assets. And then there are also a number of advisors who are used to buying actively managed mutual funds in 401ks or elsewhere and believe in the power of active management and the ability of strong active managers to outperform.
Against all evidence, I might add, but yes.
Yes. I mean, you know, we could spend 2 hours sort of, you know, hashing that out, honestly, but the reality is there are some managers who are able to generate some outperformance. Whether or not that's actual alpha or risk-adjusted performance is another conversation for another day. But, you know, there's a number of advisors who've been in the business for a long time. They you know, not to sort of say that there's just a pure skew between older and younger advisors in terms of active use versus passive use, but there are advisors who have built a business, a very good business, around using actively managed mutual funds to service their clients. And far be it from me to tell an advisor how they should run their business or how they should invest their clients' assets. I mean, the reality is that it's a very difficult business. It's tough to build a book. It's tough to foster and to usher relationships through changing market conditions. And although we know now that asset allocation is very much the most important decision an advisor makes, and for all intents and purposes, asset allocation has become commoditized, right? You can go, I could do a Google search right now and say, what's a 60-40 allocation look like? And then I could go into my self-directed brokerage account and build that almost seamlessly, or I could buy an ETF or an index mutual fund that gives me exactly what I need based on my age and my financial profile. From an asset allocation perspective. But, you know, the way that advisors differentiate themselves from each other is on top of that asset allocation, making tweaks at the margin from a tactical perspective, adding estate planning, adding trust services, adding tax planning, all of the sort of value add services along that advisor value chain that have become increasingly important and have been sort of embedded into the wrap fee that these advisors charge. And so, you know, it's easy to sit back and say, well, you buy actively managed mutual funds, so, you know, you're sort of, you know, you're denying the reality of the data. But if you have a taxable account, for example, and you've owned an active manager for 15 years and you've got capital gains in that portfolio of significant size, you're not doing a service to your clients by switching to a passive ETF per se, because then, you know, you're forced to realize gains and wealthier clients might not be all that enthusiastic about doing so. So there is some of this cyclicality in the market that will ultimately unlock some of those mutual fund assets, I believe, as advisors pivot or as assets are passed on to dependents and move to a different advisor and so on and so forth. So I think some of this has to do with demographics. Some of it has to do with the nature of this market cycle, and some of it has to do with taxation.
Yeah, it makes total sense. I mean, I have to imagine the fact that mutual funds kind of hit their stride in terms of, you know, everybody having them in their 401k or in even their non-tax deferred accounts, starting really in the late 70s and early 80s. I mean, they've obviously been around for a lot longer than that, but they really gathered a massive amount of assets during one of the great bull runs in American history. And so by the time you had your next real bear market, the great tech unwind of 2000 and 2002, there had really been so many long-term gains embedded in those mutual funds that at least anything that was in a non-tax deferred account, the idea of rolling that over to a different fund that essentially gives you the same asset class exposure to save on a few basis points or on an occasional capital gains bill at the end of the year when you were going to be essentially paying huge amounts of taxes. Do you imagine that has something to do with the stickiness of the assets also?
Yeah. I mean, let's not forget that the ETF wrapper hasn't even been around for 30 years. I mean, the first ETF launched in the 90s. So, you know, you mentioned it, but mutual funds have been around for nearly 100 years. I mean, you know, there is sort of a period of time where mutual funds took off. And I think you were right, the 70s, 80s, and to some degree, the 90s were a significant growth period for mutual funds. And the growth from the financial crisis to now in ETF assets has been tremendous, but it's still somewhat of a young structure. And, you know, the disruptive nature of ETFs has been prolific, and I think will continue to be prolific as it relates to mutual funds. But the reality is that, you know, nothing is impervious to the forces of competition and of disruption. And there are other disruptive forces in the marketplace that are going to come after the ETF. And so, you know, ETF issuers are doing the best they can to innovate, whether it be thematic products, whether it be not active, non-transparent strategies, whatever it might be. But, you know, direct indexing is certainly something that, while it hasn't gained as much momentum as maybe people were predicting a couple of years ago, it is still something that at the very least is a threat to some of these ETF assets. And then you think about tokenization of investments on various blockchains as another threat to the ETF wrapper. I mean, everything has and should have challengers that ultimately improve the investor experience. And that's what ETFs, in my opinion, have done to the traditional mutual fund wrapper. But there's nothing to say that something can't come along that might displace some of these ETF assets as well.
Yeah, I assume at some point something will come along. It'd be hard to imagine us sitting here in 100 years from now talking about this and still talking about ETFs as the latest, greatest innovation in financial engineering. So yeah, I assume it's a matter of if and not when. So you mentioned semi-transparent, actively managed ETFs. There's been a bunch that have launched in 2020, five different models currently out there, Precidian, Fidelity, Blue Tractor, a bunch of different ways of skinning this cat. And I'm just curious if you view this as ultimately a positive development for investors or as essentially a way for financial advisory firms or for asset managers to get those fees back up to something maybe not, you know, active mutual fund levels. They obviously don't have 12b1 fees and other things of that nature, but to get those fees higher than they've been able to charge with exchange traded funds.
Yeah, so SS&C Alps is very, very active in the servicing side of the ETF business. We provide services to other ETF issuers, back office and administrative support for issuers who are looking to bring their strategies to market in the ETF wrapper. And we have also sort of thrown our hat in the ring in this non-transparent or semi-transparent active basket as well. And so, you know, it is something that the firm is looking to participate in and support. And so in that way, I do think that if investors are looking for a way to sort of tap into the expertise and experience and active management capabilities of an active manager, then, you know, the ETF wrapper to me is a logical place for them to have that opportunity, given the widespread adoption of ETFs. I will say this, that, you know, the question to me isn't necessarily about ETF versus mutual fund for active. In many ways, it's about active versus passive.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think you have to draw a sort of strong line in the sand because a lot of advisors use both. I mean, actively managed fixed income ETFs that are fully transparent have seen tremendous growth in assets. And so those are really popular strategies that clearly many advisors and institutions believe do add value above the ag or above whatever the passive benchmark is in the category. And so in that way, it's not as if actively managed ETFs don't exist and haven't been popular. They just have been more or less limited to the fixed income category outside of a couple one-off actively managed equity strategies like innovation and technology or some of the products in that category. Now, that said, I think what's happening is you have a lot of asset managers who feel strongly about their active family and believe strongly that active management has a role to play in investor portfolios, and they might not be in a place to launch passive ETFs that they feel will be competitive from a price or scale or liquidity perspective and some of these sort of core categories. I think it's fair to say that the sort of cheap beta strategies in equity and fixed income are owned by sort of the big three. I mean, I think many asset managers probably feel strongly about that. And so if you're saying to yourself from a strategic perspective, we need to find a way to participate in the growth of ETFs while defending the IP that we think is critically important to the success of our business, then launching an active non-transparent ETF makes a ton of sense. But the question, of course, becomes, does the universe of ETF investors really want active in any shape or form? And we know that they do want it in the fixed income space. We know that they want it to some degree in the sort of emerging technology or disruptive technology space, but it remains to be seen if they want an active, non-transparent, large cap value ETF or an active, non-transparent, large cap growth ETF, because there's a million of those mutual funds out there. And whether or not that's something that will resonate with ETF investors, I think remains to be seen.
Yeah, certainly. I guess we'll find out relatively soon, because in addition to all the launches there have been, I saw just across the wires, I think yesterday or the day before, Fidelity is planning on launching a Magellan version, ETF version of their Magellan fund, which of course was popularized under Peter Lynch. It hasn't had quite as many assets recently as Contra Fund. Will Danoff has become their flagship actively managed fund, but it's still a relatively large fund, I think $16 billion in AUM or so. And seeing those kinds of big names come into an ETF wrapper, I think will kind of put the rubber to the road, and we'll see if investors in the ETF space are actually interested in these funds. Of course, you mentioned fixed income, and you know, people like Jeffrey Gundlach have obviously done a great job of launching active fixed income. It's obviously a market with very different dynamics, less transparent. And so it makes sense that there would be the ability to achieve some alpha or something approximating it in an active way that maybe doesn't exist in the large cap US or developed equity space.
Absolutely.
With so many ETFs to choose from, how do you find the ones that are best for your portfolio? Personally, I always start my ETF searches with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener, a product I came up with and helped build in 2015. Utilizing Seeking Alpha's proprietary ETF taxonomy system and powered by data from Morningstar and CapIQ, the ETF Screener now has a greatly improved user interface. Try the brand new data sliders, allowing you to create much more granular screens and locate the funds that best match your investing style and risk tolerance. I have personally built my own ETF portfolio, as well as my three kids' college saving plans and my parents' non-tax deferred ETF portfolios, starting with Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener each time. And what's best, Seeking Alpha's ETF Screener is totally free to use. So why not give the ETF Screener a try today by going to seekingalpha.com and typing the words ETF Screener into the search bar at the top of the site. The Seeking Alpha Marketplace offers something for every type of investor. Find the investing community that best suits your style, needs, and risk profile. So what are you waiting for? Go to seekingalpha.com/marketplace to learn more. In terms of trends towards increasingly complex financial instruments placed inside of an ETF wrapper, recent data from Robinhood and elsewhere suggests that novice investors are doing things like buying and holding triple leveraged ETFs. Obviously, you know, not that there's kind of an ETF reputation overall, but in terms of the feeling that maybe many newer investors have about these products, where maybe they haven't read the fine print properly, they haven't read the prospectus, they're going to turn around and say, you know, maybe 6 months from now in some kind of a back and forth market, well, I don't get it. I was owning, you know, SPXU, triple long pro shares ETF, and S&P's up 10%. Why isn't my ETF up 30%? Why is it actually flat over that period? And so I'm just wondering if you feel that the ETF industry has done enough to protect less experienced investors from some of these exotic products, and maybe what else can be done there.
Well, I think if you look at some of the legacy brokerages, Fidelity included in that mix, there has been a number of steps taken to sort of make it so that investors don't sort of blindly buy a leveraged inverse ETF or maybe an ETF that has unique risk characteristics compared to sort of your classic beta ETF, a window that pops up, an additional disclosure, an additional requirement that you check a box or sign off on something. And I'm not familiar with the Robinhood platform per se. I'm not a Robinhood client, and so I'm not sure if they have the same types of flags or same types of screens or same types of disclosures that some of these other brokerage firms have adopted. So in some ways, this feels like an old movie that's being replayed, in the sense that we've had these discussions. I remember having these discussions when I was working at ETF.com about how we can better sort of protect investors from themselves as it relates to some of these riskier leverage and inverse products. And in that way, I think the ETF marketplace has done a great job of improving the education and disclosures around some of these products, and trying to ensure that the people who buy these products are doing so appropriately. But you know, there's an evolution in behavior. I mean, Robinhood and some of the other fintech firms that cobble together your change and invest on your behalf. I mean, this segment of the market is very new, and so they're like any other firm, learning how they can improve their business practices and their governance and the way that they service investors. And so I don't know that if you're the issuer of an inverse or leverage ETF, that there's anything more per se that you could do other than what you're doing, which is ensuring that your prospectus is up to date and then any collateral you have supporting those products is appropriate. Because, you know, we talked about the democratic nature of ETFs. I mean, anybody can buy an ETF that has access to a brokerage account, more or less. And that's not the same for mutual funds, right? If you want to buy a mutual fund, it has to be on the platform, it has to be approved, there has to be an agreement in place, distribution agreement, et cetera. Whereas, you know, that's the beauty of the ETF wrapper from an issuer perspective, is you're not beholden to any one firm from a distribution perspective. Basically, anyone can buy it. Now, if you're an advisor at a wirehouse, they have approved or recommended lists, and so they might not let you buy certain ETFs below that don't have a certain amount of assets in them or what have you. But if you're a self-directed investor trading on name the brokerage, you can basically buy any ETF you want. And I don't know that it's incumbent upon the ETF issuer to sort of step in and prevent someone from buying their leveraged or inverse ETF. To me, it's incumbent upon the platform where that person is buying it to provide the types of disclosures and flags and preventative measures to ensure that, you know, whoever's buying it understands the risks and it's appropriate for them.
Yeah, you know what? I think that's actually a valid point. I think that it at least it strikes me as somewhat odd that you need special permission, for example, to sell individual securities short, but then you can turn around and buy a triple leveraged inverse ETF without any special permission. Same with trading options. You generally need special permissions on most brokers. And it seems like, you know, maybe there should be some paperwork involved where people are forced to take a 30-minute course and prove that they have some basic understanding. But totally take your point that this is really not on the issuers any more than it's on Apple to prevent novice investors from selling Apple shares short. It's really not on them. It's on the brokers in that case. So I think it's a good perspective. So I'd love to pivot over to your time at Alps and really your bread and butter right now. Starting from kind of a broad bird's eye view, how would you describe the Alps ETF lineup and what would you say sets it apart, makes it unique from other ETF issuers' lineups?
Well, I would say that Alps has leaned into the thematic categories in a way that's somewhat unique to other issuers. And so we've got renewable energy as well as disruptive technology and medical breakthroughs ETFs that capture some of these themes that have sort of, you know, been, I think, at the top of investor minds, whether it be from firms like Motif who are trying to offer these types of themes in a different way and other firms who have launched thematic products and seen great success, whether it be on a one-off basis or through a lineup. And then we've also done a number of partnerships with third-party firms whereby an RIA like Riverfront, for example, comes to us and says, look, we've been giving away these ideas to issuers over the years. We feel strongly that we've got some strong IP behind this product to help us launch an ETF based on an index or a strategy that we've created. And so we've got a suite of Riverfront strategies that are income oriented or dividend oriented or even sort of unconstrained income, multi-asset income strategies. And then As you know, we're a distributor for third-party ETFs as well. And so you sort of, in some ways, cobble together some categories that are really, their opportunity set is at the margins of an asset allocation, right? Alps isn't a firm that offers your bargain basement S&P 500 index ETF or your bargain basement small cap ETF. What Alps does really well is we partner with really interesting indexers or advisors who have unique IP that we think is additive to the current landscape of ETFs. And you go back in time to when we launched AMLP 10 years ago, we just had our 10-year anniversary, and we had Alarion, thank you. And we had Alarion come to us and say, we've got this really unique and industry-leading index of MLPs. It's not a product set that exists in the ETF wrapper. We think it'll be the first of its kind. We think it'll be really successful. And you know, through that partnership, we've forged a new path for ETF issuers to create sort of bucketed exposure to pockets in the market that, while they might not be a significant portion of your asset allocation of your investment strategy, certainly provide alternatives to the way that traditional market delineation works. And what I mean by that is, for example, you think about ACES, our clean energy ETF. I think it's relevant now. Maybe we can get into a little bit more. But if you look at how GICS works, right, the framework for determining what companies belong to what sectors in the economy, there's 11 sectors. And the companies fit neatly into those various buckets by virtue of that GICS methodology. And it's really useful, especially relative to, say, the style box in terms of separating out economic exposures and cyclicality and things of that nature and grouping companies together that have similar economic exposures and similar market sensitivities. But, you know, that can be challenging when you say something like clean energy, because in theory, you could only pull from energy companies within the energy sector to sort of build that portfolio, at least by definition of the GICS format. Whereas the clean energy ETF is sort of multi-sector, and it doesn't fit as perfectly in the sort of traditional definition of a sector breakdown. And so you end up having pieces of the portfolio that pull from technology or pull from utilities or pull from energy. And you have this sort of this sector breaker, if you will, portfolio that ultimately allows an investor who has a legacy energy ETF, say XLE, the Select Sector Spider Energy ETF, and complement it with a clean energy ETF in a way that they wouldn't have been able to if they just stood pat with their legacy energy position.
Yeah, sure. In terms of which funds ALPS has in its lineup, which you think are particularly relevant to the current market environment, I'd be very curious to hear what you come up with here.
So, I mean, I mentioned ACES. I think it's super relevant right now based on the fact that, like you said, on our previous discussion, the presidential debate was last night. The topic of the Green New Deal or progressive energy policy or a change to our energy infrastructure and energy approach is likely to change with an election of Joe Biden, perhaps a Democratic sweep in the Senate. Investors are thinking about ways that they can position their exposure, how legacy fossil fuel companies are at risk as a result of that. And so ACES is a portfolio that's super relevant right now because it invests in a lot of these themes that are likely, or a lot of these companies that are likely to benefit from any meaningful change to that energy policy. It mixes all of the different, or many of the different segments of quote unquote renewable energy that investors might want to have exposure to that are likely to benefit from increased incentives or subsidies or whatever it might be. You're talking wind, you're talking solar, efficiency, LED, smart grid, fuel cell, hydro, biomass, etc. So it's sort of a theme of themes, if you could think about it in that way. The other one in that thematic suite that I think is relevant right now is S-Bio, which is a medical breakthroughs ETF. And it's relevant because of all of the vaccine research that's currently ongoing around COVID different ways that investors are sort of looking to get exposure to emerging companies in the healthcare space, understanding that regardless of COVID and the vaccine development and therapeutics that are being developed specifically for this disease, there's also the demographics of this country, which are very much in line with a healthcare sector that's likely to be a bigger part of our economy, to be asked to do newer and more important things in terms of delivering care to a largely aging population. And so the companies that are able to develop oncology and immunotherapy for solving various types of cancer or for treating different types of elderly disease, whether it be dementia or Parkinson's or any number of these degenerative diseases. This is a way that investors can get exposure to some of those themes within the theme that ultimately are riding the wave of both demographics and venture capital investment, as well as speculative investment in companies that may or may not make it to sort of the final stage of the approval process, but are at least providing what is, I think, critically new approaches, new research that if it doesn't actually manifest itself in terms of a drug or in terms of an actual treatment, will inform the development of other drugs and other treatments. And in that way, having exposure to biotechnology through sort of your classic passive index in the ETF wrapper might not help you achieve that goal in the same way that something like S-Bio does. And so therefore S-Bio might be complementary to your cap-weighted healthcare exposure or your cap-weighted biotechnology exposure.
Sure. Looking at a fund like ACES, the ALPS Clean Energy ETF, that's ticker symbol ACES, first of all, really just phenomenal return over the last quarter, up more than 2% on a total return basis. I see you also have companies like Tesla in the top 10 holdings there, which makes sense. You referenced GIX, and I'm just curious in terms of the reality is that many pieces of the clean energy revolution are likely to not only come from pure plays, but from companies like Exxon and Chevron, and on the automobile side, companies like General Motors and Ford, who, while no one would classify them as clean energy plays in the year 2020, they see the changing winds. They realize that this is the direction the world's heading in. They're putting increasing amounts of R&D into renewable energy sources, into more fuel efficient cars. And so how does that play into the way an index like that is constructed? Does it have to be pure play only at one point? At what point does one of these more traditional, less clean energy plays in the space enter under consideration for an index?
Well, I think the key point is that you're absolutely right. Exxon and Chevron and some of these legacy fossil fuel companies have dumped a tremendous amount of R&D and investment into alternative energy sources, whether it be wind, solar, or even biofuels or the like. And so the reality is that you have exposure to those companies in your investment portfolio, most likely, whether it be your S&P 500 fund, or as I said, your diversified energy fund, or your diversified industrials fund in the case of various inputs into the legacy fossil fuel industry or the automobile industry, and then, within the consumer discretionary space and so on and so forth. And so, you know, this is, I think, the part of the puzzle that ACES is designed to sort of fill is that it's a complement in many ways. So you get this sort of targeted exposure to augment the exposure that you have to companies who might be, quote unquote, dabbling in this segment. It might emerge as significant players and leaders in this space. But, you know, if you look at, say, an energy portfolio, yes, you have Exxon and Chevron, who are very much players in the renewable and alternative energy categories. But then you have down the spectrum, E&P companies, who are pure play fossil fuel companies, or you have oil service companies, who are more or less pure plays on servicing legacy fossil fuel companies, and so on and so forth. And so, in that way, getting ACES alongside that gives you a way to play the sort of here and the future. And then you think sort of the two would converge at some point as the energy sector evolves into this renewable energy future, and the companies within ACES sort of grow into eligibility for some of these broader market indexes as their market caps rise and so on and so forth. And in that way, it's similar to how we've talked to advisors about AMLP versus ACES, for example, in the sense that, you know, everyone in many ways, I think, overstates the near-term impact of a renewable energy policy or a Green New Deal on legacy fossil fuels, specifically natural gas. Like we talked about on the other call, 50% of AMLP's portfolio is focused on natural gas companies. And natural gas is the biggest input to electricity in this country, electricity generation in this country. So in that way, even in a future state where everyone plugs their car into their garage, that electricity has to come from somewhere. And it's unlikely to come from wind and solar exclusively anytime soon, certainly not in the next 5 to 10 years. And so natural gas will continue to be a bridge to that future, or whatever that future may look like. And so if you have something like AMLP in your portfolio, it sort of checks some boxes in terms of giving you exposure to legacy hydrocarbons and the infrastructure that connects it from production to demand. But also you have the bridge between that current state and the future state by virtue of the natural gas exposure within the portfolio. And then finally, ACES as a way to give you some optionality on that future renewable energy state. And oh, by the way, AMLP provides a source of income for income-oriented investors that would be supplemental to the lack of income currently being thrown off by something like ACES.
Sure. So it sounds like you're describing a core and satellite approach here, where investors can take a theme that they believe must, by definition, be a hot, you know, fast-growing theme over the next decade, two decades, even longer, and tweaking your portfolio to more reflect a kind of future-oriented outlook there. Makes a lot of sense. Speaking of AMLP and just dividends or real yields in particular, you guys have Sector Dividend Dogs ETF, SDOG, which I think in this low rate environment might be of particular interest to many listeners. What can you say about this fund and how investors can maybe turn to it in an environment where the tenure is, you know, 60 basis points or whatever it is, and you're not going to get real yield from government issued debt right now?
Yeah, so it's sort of this really traditional strategy, the dogs of the Dow theory, where you're basically taking the highest yielding stocks from the Dow and overweighting them or owning them relative to the lowest yielding stocks in the Dow. And this is obviously going back to a time where more stocks paid dividends. Dividends were a bigger part of the investment lexicon, and companies that had a high yield were basically companies whose share price had underperformed the rest of the index. And so what the product did was it took that dogs of the Dow theory and it applied it to the S&P 500, but in a unique way. You take the five highest yielding securities in 10 of the 11 GIC sectors, excluding real estate, and you ultimately then have equal weighted exposure to all of the sectors in the market. So, you know, instead of having, say, a 2% weight to energy, you have a 10% weight to energy. Instead of having a 3% or 4% weight to utilities, you have a 10% weight to utilities. Instead of having a 25% weight to technology, you have a 10% weight to technology. And so, you know, it's a unique spin on the dividend story in the sense that you look at some of these other dividend products and they're simply screening for the highest yielding companies in the S&P 500 or the Russell 1000 or whatever the universe may be, and then weighting them based on their yield. They're weighting them based on the fundamental characteristics of that yield, payout ratio, or what have you. And they don't necessarily focus on the sectors at all. You just end up having the sector exposure that you have by virtue of the companies that you've picked based on their yield or the fundamentals of the yield, whereas SDOG equal weights the various sectors in the market and picks the highest yielding stocks in those various sectors. And what we've done is over time, we've added a number of different strategies that take this concept and apply it to different markets, whether it be EDOG, the emerging version, or emerging markets version, or IDOG, the international version, or now RDOG, which is specifically focused on the real estate sector. And so you're right. I mean, investors are looking for yield in places that they might not have looked for it in the past, given the nature of interest rates currently in the country and around the world. But they also are looking at sort of different versions of the yield story, which is where SDOG and the like come in.
Sure. And it sounds like they allow investors to both collect yields, but also if they're looking towards some sort of sector rotation, so it underweights what's been outperforming and overweights what's been underperforming by nature of the market caps. And so definitely an interesting approach there. And I believe your largest fund, correct?
Our largest fund is actually AMLP, but
oh right, sorry, not AMLP.
That's fine, yeah. But yeah, SDOG is certainly up there, just shy of $1 billion in assets under management, and again, it's one of these ETFs that's sort of been around for quite a while, is sort of seasoned in terms of its trading and in terms of its investor engagement, and I'll just make one more point here that I think is germane, is the idea of sort of the divergence between growth and value in recent times. And the dividend factor is very closely aligned with the value factor. And so investors, to your point, who might be overweight technology and might have a growth posture in their investment portfolio by virtue of that divergence, could use a dividend strategy as a way to sort of reel back in their overweight exposure to growth and maybe tilt a little bit more toward value.
Sure. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Anyway, Paul, this has been great. I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today. Back-to-back episodes. I've been taking up your time for close to 2 hours.
This has been great. Thank you, Jonathan. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been excellent. So you want to just remind listeners where they can continue to research everything we've discussed here today?
Sure. AlpsFunds.com is the homepage. You can get information on all of our ETFs as well as the various other product structures that we offer, whether it be actively managed mutual funds or closed-end funds. But ultimately, the website is a repository of a tremendous amount of information and insights and research, videos, interviews from various members of the team. And of course, to the extent that anyone has any additional questions, don't hesitate to reach out and contact your wholesaler, and we can set up some time to discuss any of these topics or more.
Nice. All right. Anyway, best of luck, Paul.
Right back at you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Be well.
Yeah, you too.
For disclosures, neither Paul Baiocchi or Jonathan Liss have positions in any of the funds or securities discussed in today's show. If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on SeekingAlpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.